I think decadent's quite interesting because I think it's assumed that it's decadent slash bad and not decadent slash good, or I think going from what Lynn was saying about foot washing for the soul, in the sense that if only it's necessary for that to be a one-on-one experience. I mean, yes, it's repeatable and it's not scalable in the terms of simultaneous numbers of people being able to take part, but there's no reason why it can't just go on for as long as it's sort of interesting. And I think that it's just there is a certain pressure not to like get into the money side of it at all, but like about where the value is attributed, I think, because I think that the obvious return on something with a larger audience number is a lot more instantly tangible, and I think someone asked, would you make that the work that you make for more people if you could, like if it didn't cost us blah x number of probably tens, hundreds of pounds maybe per person, and so that would be to scale up as well to make the same piece of work, would you do it? And I don't know, I think the slight pressure comes from something, if you're like the piece of work that we've made here that is publicly funded, and then you just know that you feel a bit sort of like, I'm sorry that we can't just share it to as many people as possible, but we are sharing it to as many people as possible. And I think that we looked at it and thought, well, this is the number of people that we need to talk to in this show in order to give the experience we want to give. And if that means it's decadent, and if that means that it has to be exclusive in order for us to have that intimacy or that conversation, and for it to be manageable for us, and for it to be affordable for us just to be able to do the idea that we've had, that I don't really have a problem about whether it's decadent or not, because I don't think that that's really a good or a bad thing. I guess that you didn't imply that one way or another, but I guess maybe just for me to separate those two things as not necessarily having a bearing on each other.
Okay, does anyone have a question?
This was touched on really briefly, and I'm quite interested in the idea of this being a very middle class thing. There's actually a luxury to play when it comes to the ability to let go of a version of yourself and take on another. And so I did some basic gaming with kids in sort of centre of Manchester with Larkin Bout, and a game that I ran required that two people held hands, and none of the teenage boys were even a little bit willing to do that, and we had to change the game so that they would be able to play. And they weren't middle class, and they had a lot of trouble with the idea of letting go of certain versions of themselves in order to play. So I'd love to hear your thoughts more deeply on the whole middle class thing, if it's a problem or if it's something just worth thinking about.
I said that, so I suppose I should. I think I was thinking more of Edinburgh rather than the audience for all. Like, clearly, playing and interacting and is a genuinely evolutionarily proven universal thing. Like, you know, we play to evolve, we play to learn, we play to socialise. You know, like there's tons of ways, and then we, you know, like again, my terminology, I know we're talking about interaction and drama, but like if we can bound all of that under playing, then that is a primal universal activity. Yeah, there is totally then another strata of that, which is whether people feel agency, and whether they feel willing and able, and also whether in situations where you are trying to please the authority of the artist who's given you some choices to do and some things to fulfil, the sort of willingness and enthusiasm to kind of go along with that. You know, some people, well, I don't have that kind of native sort of willingness to please necessarily. My experience of designing games and playing them with kind of young people from different communities, different backgrounds, is always it ends up being a wonderful experience. But yeah, I think you do sometimes have to, it is a good way of investigating some of the assumptions about what you're asking people to do, to ask different kinds of people to do it and see how they take it.
Yeah, I could feel the kind of hair stand up on the back of my neck a little bit when you sort of introduced that, because I led a workshop in Adelaide where one of the exercises ended up with about 8 or 10 of us walking through a street in Adelaide all holding hands, and I happened to be in the gang, you know, in a group where there were 4 or 5 of us guys who were all holding hands. And, you know, it totally pings all of my sensibilities into play, and, you know, I suddenly had that thing of like, God, you know, that I understood something about what it must be like to be a gay couple straight away from just this sense of, at the moment that we made that decision to hold hands and walk through the street. So it's very powerful. I mean, I would say the broader question is just about the cultural specificity that you have. As we've done work around the world, it's very, very different in different places, and you can't make kind of easy assumptions about how people do that. You know, we did a piece in Tokyo once where the person who invited us went to every single shop in the area that the game would be played to introduce himself and explain what was going to be happening in advance, because he felt that that was a basic level of courtesy before people were running around in the streets near their shops. You know, and there are just all of those levels are at play. So I don't think it's necessarily just about class. It's about, you know, region, and it's about urban audiences versus non-urban audiences, and also just about audiences who are down with this and audiences who aren't. You know, and sometimes we've gone to places where every single audience who comes, they're completely baffled by the idea that they're expected to do something, and it sometimes it works, and sometimes they're just, you know, like rabbit in the headlights because it's just so outside their frame of reference.
We once ran a sandpit at the Sheffield Documentary Festival, and partly it was because we were up against 2 free drinks networking events, but it did seem that from our attempts to kind of pitch the notion of coming and playing some games, that documentary filmmakers were not the most playful cohort people.
I wonder if I could talk about a Blast Theory piece of work really quickly. So I'm the artist assistant of Blast Theory, so whatever I say, just ignore it probably. But specifically with what you were mentioning there about the workshops you did with younger people in Manchester, Blast Theory did a piece of work last year called Ivy Forever, which was a work for young adults, people 14 to 17, and involved you using your mobile phone to send text messages to the character Ivy over the period of a week. And we were really keen to trial the project in Brighton, where we're based, and to do our best. We're a really small team, but to sort of do some outreach and really go and introduce the project personally to a lot of groups, youth groups and other groups like that. And myself and the intern at the time, Serena or Hugo, not really important to the story.
Nice middle class names.
Yes. They are Portuguese and Italian. Portuguese defense.
It sounds great, didn't it? Serena and Hugo.
Yeah, the two of us went to the Young Offenders Centre in the middle of Brighton to go and introduce the project personally and to kind of try and get people to sign up. And we went in, and it was just like the hardest sell ever had to do, because you sort of said, I was like, look at this game, this character, you know, is it a project in association with Channel 4? Channel 4, Channel 4. The people who do skins. and they were like, yeah, right. And I was like, so, you know, you spend a week on your phone, and this character will text you, and you text her back. And they were like, why? And it was like, because it's interesting. I wasn't very good at this, though. And I did say better things than that. But regardless, they were like, right, so I've got to use up my credit to play this game. And you were like, yeah. And the liaison officer was saying, well, I think it's a bit much to ask these guys to spend their phone credit to play this game. Essentially, they saw it as doing us a massive favour, because I just couldn't put the point across in any way of not being able to relate at all as to why it might be really, you know. I was honestly personally believe that I thought they could get something really good out of it, on a personal level, but it was, I didn't know how to articulate it. And I think that the way the liaisons officer said it is they're not going to spend like £3 playing your game when that £3 could buy them a McDonald's, and like her words. And it was just difficult to sort of argue against that, because you don't just want to say, but it'll be jolly interesting, because like it was, you know, and we didn't have any budget to be going to every single group that we were going to and saying, well, here's £20 for you to put credit on your phone, please play, let us know what you think, because it's just like, well, if you've already made that choice, it's like we're not in the position of sort of saying, well, if we do this, then do you want to play? And if we make it slightly, if you make your situation slightly different, will it be more interesting for you?
I think what you end up with as makers is you're always, I think, something that I'm really exercised about is platforms, and thinking really carefully about platforms that upon which work rests. You know, theatre is one kind of platform, SMS is another kind of platform. All platforms have kind of affordances and possibilities and limitations. I mean, the brilliant thing about SMS is you don't need a computer, so you know, you're already one step further down the kind of technology cost ladder in that a £10 phone can do it, whereas you don't, you know, you're not needing, you know, to be a middle class kid with, you know, well, sorry, I'm just thinking, stop saying that. You don't need to be able to afford a computer to interact with the work. So it is progressive in that way, but it still comes with its own set of challenges, and one of those challenges is you can't get around paying for SMSs for people to engage with something. Then every one of these platforms, I think it's really important to kind of make a discussion about the platform as much part of the discussion of the work as the discussion of its content and its presentation and its interactivity.
We had a project down in Leith called Murmur, which finished back in 2009. It was a project that I inherited and became, and still actually seems to be, the bane of my life sometimes, because it seems to be that very middle-class academics and critics think it's the most wonderful thing. You can go down to essentially quite a poor part of town, whip out your mobile phone, dial a number on a bright green ear that's been attached to a lamppost, and hear a story about the history of that place. But down there, most people will not spend the credit on my mobile phone on dialing a number on a big green ear. And I still get people complaining to me saying, why did you take them down? They were marvellous. I'm coming all the way from Devon to see the green ears. And I'm like, we're always getting requests for people wanting to put pictures in publications about this. I'm thinking, yes, but fundamentally it was a flawed project because the audience, the local audience, didn't engage with it whatsoever. Because why would they do it? Why do they need to do this? In any case, they asked their moms, they asked their dads about, well, what was Leith like? They didn't need a green ear. So it was flawed when it came down to it. And technology has come along now, you wouldn't do it that way anymore. But at that time, it was seen to be something that was really quite marvellous. And I'm amazed continually. And actually, most of the things that are referenced academically about New Media Scotland is always about that goddamn project. And I'm like, come on, the world has moved on. So it seems as though there's a problem at some level in terms of middle classness that actually doesn't really address the fact that society's changed or technology has changed and you're not moving along with it. So, you know.
Personally, I don't think it's necessarily that based in technology as well. I think one of the pieces that Non-Zero One have done is a piece called Hold Hands, Lock Horns, which is you go through a choice map and that's really kind of it. And then we just ask you about what choices it is that you've made. And yes, we performed that piece at the basement and we performed it in certain places where we had the same sort of audience. But then we were invited to take it up to Leeds and we did it in a shopping mall in the middle of Leeds where this totally different sort of audience could come and try it out. And it was just as interesting and it worked just as kind of well or as badly, depending on how you took it, doing it for that sort of audience in a shopping mall in Leeds as it did for an arts audience that came to the basement on Friday night. Like, it's kind of that thing about the Arts Council saying of great art for everybody, which making intimate work kind of can send your hairs back because you kind of think, oh God, by saying that, do they think great art for loads and loads and loads of people? And I don't necessarily think that that's what they mean personally. I think what it means is kind of making pieces that can work and that can appeal to people no matter what background you're from, no matter what money you have. And I think it is difficult making that work if you're using stuff like technology that's more widely available for certain people with certain amounts of money or things like that.
I think it's also, coming back to what you're saying, I think it's about actually projects that you know, are really well thought out and that are absolutely embedded in the communities in which they happen. And I think one of the things that just slightly concerns me at the moment in the world of theatre, in the kind of rush for to make participatory work, it's as if almost that you end up with kind of artists, you know, parachuting into communities, and where the benefit is actually for the artist, really, rather than it is actually for that community, and which leaves absolutely no legacy whatsoever for that community, but may well leave a lot of very good reviews for the artist. Yeah. Yeah.
Good question. We talked about that for a long time. Was there anybody else? Sorry, and then we'll come to you guys.
Yeah, I was interested to hear the rest of the talking about a sense of responsibility that makes your audience. And I was wondering if there is a kind of ethics of interaction, is it one that you embed with each work that you make, or are there kind of precepts you carry with the moment to accept the kind of 10 commandments, thou shalt not touch your audience, or whatever, but do you find yourself carrying rules with you as you move from work to work, if it's not just code like this, but I'm just curious, if we have ethics of interaction, what are those ethics?
Yeah, I mean, sorry, I'm going to speak again, but yeah, absolutely, and it does develop from project to project, and I think it's in you use exactly the right words, because I think it is an ethics, because it's a flexible thing. It's not, you know, it's not hard and fast rules about things, but there might be rules of thumb that you would generally employ. Like I personally don't generally believe that you should set up interactions with people where things happen to them that are outside of their expectation about the kind of genre within which this interaction takes place. For example, you know, I personally feel fairly strongly against the idea that you would scare people or you do things, you know, things like that. You know, I'm sure every person who makes work of this kind has their own sort of boundaries, but I think it is really, really important that you understand how scary very modest forms of interaction actually are, you know. And I can remember learning it very much on one particular workshop where we were instructed to put balaclavas over our head, bags over our heads, and do interaction where we were all touching each other and stuff like that. And it freaked a number of people out to the point of tears. You know, within 5 or 10 minutes, some people were extremely upset because they didn't know what was going on or why or whatever. So, you know, I couldn't sort of really list you those things, but it's something that we talk about remorselessly, you know, really, really often. Partly because our work's taking place out on the street, and so you're therefore in an environment where people may well get mugged or abused or get lost, or, you know, thankfully those things have never happened to us, but those things are all real, real risks, and we take it really seriously that someone could step off pavement while they're busy in the latest Blast Theory show and get run down, and it's, you know, you have to take those things into consideration. So,
and the other people using those streets, you know, it's not, you know, there is a function of outdoor interactive work, which part of which is the excitement of being in a different world while you're in the world. There's a frisson and an excitement to that, which is great and definitely a thing to work with as one of the parts of the tool set of artists experimenting in this area. But you have to recognise that everybody else isn't. And if the thing that you're doing as a participant makes you forget other people to the point where you might be running so fast to get something that you elbow somebody out of the way, or you end up shouting something really loud in a place where people are kind of being quiet and stuff, that's also a problem. It's not just the world acting on the participant, but the participant acting on the world under your instruction.
Yeah, and you know, given the events of the last couple of weeks, we are freshly reminded of the fact that the street is one of the places where the major political changes of our societies actually takes place, and that you're therefore in a political space when you send people out into those environments, and therefore you are, you know, there's a set of ideologies at work that you have to be at some degree master of, or some degree have a sense of understanding about. And I think, you know, that's partly what I've kind of been driving at in some of my earlier sort of criticisms a little bit of interactive work.
Thank you. I mean,
Harry,
like,
I was just going to say, but I think there's also a difference, say, between the ethics that come through the content of what you're being asked to do and the ethics that are embedded in the work through its structure itself. So the structure of the work carries its own ethics, and certain kinds of structures are already suggesting models of certain kinds of power or social relationships. And so I think it's really interesting you mentioned this work that I'm about to see next week that involves the audience simulating robbing a bank in the context of recent events. And so there's that question of what you might be inciting us, although as play, to do, but also how, and I guess I'll find out, how are you orchestrating that in terms of the ethics of the communication, and what are the conflicts at play there, and are they what you intend? And I think what often gets concentrated on is the content at the expense of the structure itself. And, you know, even we've opted for a very 19th century, you know, way of sitting and having this discussion. We're not in a circle. Maybe that's practicalities about numbers, but it's not just about the fact that we're respectfully listening to each other. A structure was imposed as soon as we entered the space, and I think that should be interrogated as much, if not more so, than the surface layer of what question you've been asked to do at a given moment. And I think that's where this notion of interaction drifts into politics, in the sense that you have a lot of the danger of tokenistic choices you make within a performance is very dangerously close to the tokenistic voting that you might do, where there's a simulation of participation, and then we say we're in a democratic space or a democratic society. But is that actually the case? And so I think we have to keep going back to the actual structure of what's happening.
Okay, we'll just take two more questions. There's one here, and there's a lady.
Sometimes you think there might be an over-reliance on new media in interactive theatre, because I know when like some theatre companies they do stuff which is like mainly on Twitter or mainly on SMS, at first some people might be like, oh, I'll definitely follow that, I'll definitely keep on top of that. But as soon as, like, say it reaches after the first day and they realise that it might be a little bad and like it's not exactly engaging them as they thought it would do, and then they start like rejecting it as much. Do you feel like that sometimes it can be false on Twitter and SMS, rather than if it was a person, like you had to say phone them or something like that, so you chose to interact with it better? And also, it also feels like it's neglecting some people who just simply don't know how to use the likes of like Twitter, Facebook, or even like the phones. I mean, I've got a phone which is capable of a lot of things, but I only really know how to ring people on it. But I know if I really got to grips with it, I might be able to like do a show where you have to go around a certain city and take photos with it. But because I don't understand my phone as well, because I use it to just basically keep in contact with my mum, it feels like at times when theatre pieces are using technology like that, it might be neglecting someone like me, even though I'd be willing to sort of do it, but I just don't understand.
I think it's, I mean, I think there's two parallel things there, and one is, if you're making work that does rest on technology and platforms, I think actually it's important to investigate platforms and possibilities and try things out. And that does sometimes mean that you're limiting the number of people who can access something. At the same time as that, we always try and ask ourselves the question, could I be having this experience without this intermediating layer of technology that's between me and the experience? We're always trying to, this is a constant thing we're working on, as you know, but Hinterland could be a very flash digital, there's quite a lot of complex digital stuff happening in Hinterland, but you don't see any of that as the participant. You make telephone calls and receive SMSs. And I, you know, that's a conscious decision on our part to try and make a piece of work that, you know, fits into people's lives in an interesting way using an everyday piece of technology, the mobile phone, but not excessively restricting that by making the kind of the power of that mobile phone too particular. I'm not sure that anyone's really, really effectively used Twitter to make a theatre piece. The best theatre piece I've seen on Twitter is by someone called Caitlin Moran, who ran a Twitter school trip for the day, where she kind of acted as the teacher in charge of a trip to France, and everyone else sort of just played along and pretended to be the kids, and so she would tell people where they were, and it was just glorious, and it totally made use of Twitter's kind of affordances. She's not a theatre maker, but she's a journalist, but she just did it for fun, and it was lovely, and it worked, and it was short, and it did, and, you know, I think sometimes, you know, like, it's not that you shouldn't use Twitter, it's just that you should use Twitter in a way that reflects people's usage and understanding and sort of experience of it as a platform.
I think actually, you know, one of the things that's really important about this is that, you know, any kind of technology is only a tool for a theatre maker. And it would seem to me that if you are a theatre maker, then you would want to use every possible tool that is available to you. And obviously that now would include, pervasive media. But similarly, you know, you may want to, make a show with limelight and little bits of paper puppet.
Yeah.
And I just kind of think it's just using all those things, and that's what makes it exciting.
Just one thing. Yeah. The interesting thing is you actually just turned new media rather than digital media. That's what you just said, actually. What you just example, that is an example of new media practice, what you just suggested.
Right.
That's not, you know, digital media in terms of the use of Twitter, etc. They're great platforms. Mm-hmm. Early adopters, they adopt them. You can do whizzy things with them. But once they start to become so ingrained, it becomes more difficult to filter through exactly what's going on. You're more likely to set up a Twitter account so that you can specifically just follow that one project. That's what things like TweetDeck were invented for. But don't be afraid of technology. But I find it interesting that you use the term new media rather than digital media, because the one's contained within the other, but not the other way around.